Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
Cole, thank you for joining us today. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, thank you. I'm normally based in the UK, but I'm in the US. I'm in Seattle and on my way to the Sundance Film Festival.
Well, I'm jealous. Park City is beautiful. That is, I've yet to go to a Sundance Festival, but for the listeners, viewers, we have a man who I hold in high regards because we have a common passion. I think he has me beat, though. The last I checked, you have 14,700 films under your belt and you watch 2 to 3 films a day.
Yeah, now that you are a little behind. You are a little behind on this then. So we are over, or I am over, 15,300 unique films that I've seen. And I track every film that I've seen, and I've been doing that since the 1st of January, 1980. Okay, so that's 44 years. It's 2 weeks before I became a teenager. And of those 15,300 plus movies, right, those are unique movies. Okay, so if I've seen something more than once, it only counts for one in that 15,300. So for example, my all-time favorite film is Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo,
yes,
from 1958. I've seen that more than 50 times, and it only counts for one of those 15,000 plus movies.
So I've got to ask, you probably know this, is there a world record for
unique
films watched?
I'm not aiming for the record, first of all, although perhaps I should. I seem to remember from many years ago, so this will be behind the times as well. There was somebody in the UK and they had been to 20,000 movies in theatres. So their proof was they had all of the tickets. They had all of the tickets. So for me, the Guinness Book of Records would have to take my word for the fact that I've seen that many movies. I mean, I have a full history and I have the full dates and everything. But I believe the record holder actually has the physical tickets to all of the movies.
I've got to ask you point blank, and I want to get into your life and your story. For those that don't know, you were talking to the founder of IMDb, which is the database for movies. And an interesting story, but what is it about movies that draws you in?
Yeah. So I'll answer with a movie quote to start with. Okay, so my all-time favorite movie quote comes from a movie called Grand Canyon. It came out in 1991, directed by Lawrence Kasdan and co-written by him. And the quote is spoken by Steve Martin's character in the movie. And Steve Martin's character at one point says the following: "All of life's riddles are answered in the movies. All of life's riddles are answered in the movies." And so for me, I'm a great fan of story. And I think as humans, we all connect through story. It's something that's been in our nature forever. People like to hear a story. Some people are gifted in their ability to tell a story, but we're all audience members. And those stories, they can be, some people are more, they're perhaps more predisposed to like a story in the written word. Some people like stories through opera, stories that are like long television series that last forever. I just happen to be someone who believes that kind of a 2-hour block of time where it's you, an audience, and the story can just have the most remarkable life-changing impact upon you. You can be, as an audience member, you can be taken to another time, another country, another culture. You can be taken to an imaginary world that's in the future. You can be taken to a galaxy far, far away. imagined places where it might make you think, well, this seems like the current world in which we live, but something's different. And then the filmmakers played a little trick on you in this world. Nobody can tell a lie. What would that be like in this world? This magical thing happens to everybody, and it can really open your mind to those different possibilities without needing to place you in danger. Like I know your background and you have my admiration for some of the things that you've done. So I'm honored to be on the podcast because I'm just somebody who goes to movie theaters and loves stories. And I think there's nothing better than experiencing a great story with an audience. Now you can't always experience a story with an audience. So sometimes you might need to see the movie or the show at home with your family or friends or whatever your situation is. Sometimes it might just be you. The worst thing to do is to not experience the movie. So I basically feel that the world would be a better place if everybody watched more movies, because we might understand each other a lot more, and we might not get into some of the messes that we get into when we don't understand each other.
I think it's a commonality amongst all humans. I've never met anyone other than my wife who hates going to movies, and I love everything about the experience. But first off, Cole Needham just said he's honored to be on my podcast. I appreciate that. You're probably the first that has said that. But for me, movies, it's, I don't want to say it's an escape from the world, but you laugh, you cry, you smile, you think, and no matter what's going on in your life, for 2 hours, for me, it's the big tub of popcorn, the Diet Coke, and I am just glued to that thing no matter what's happened. But it's funny you mentioned that about what I did. You want to know what drew me in to that profession?
Oh, go on.
Movies.
No.
100% movies. Hollywood is the greatest military recruiting tool that they have, and they don't even know it. Because movies I watched, all the Korean War movies, the World War II movies, where it's just like, man, I want to be just like those guys.
Yeah.
Why not give it a shot?
The power. I was the right age. My second year in college. And she's now my wife, and we've been married throughout this time. But she was my girlfriend from high school. So I married my high school sweetheart, and we're 35 years married coming up this year. But we were two students. We went to college in different towns. We did the long distance relationship thing. We went to see Top Gun the weekend it opened. That is definitely a brilliant story to recruit people. And the crazy thing is, I did a computer science degree. My wife was like doing a grade school teaching degree. Okay. So we're just two kids in the north of Manchester together. 38 years later, I think it's 38 years later, we are in such an honor that this happened. We're at the world premiere of Top Gun Maverick in Cannes, that Cannes Film Festival. Tom Cruise is there. They've timed Tom's arrival to have like a military flyover over the cinema in which they're showing Top Gun. They brought Tom up on stage. They gave him an honorary Palme d'Or in advance of the movie. And I turned to my wife and I said, nobody would ever have imagined that two kids from Manchester would be at the world premiere of the sequel to Top Gun with Tom Cruise 38 years later at the Cannes Film Festival. And it's such an interesting, like, I often have to pinch myself to check I'm still in the real world and not a dream.
Well, first off, Top Gun Maverick I thought was better than the first. I heard there is a Top Gun 3 in the world.
Correct. Recently announced. We're going back.
That is risky. You got out to but we'll see.
Well, it is coming from the man, of course, who starred in Risky Business.
Yes, this is true. He's got an allegiance to Tom Cruise, who I've heard is a nice guy, by the way.
Yes.
Everyone who's very, very personable. But you know, you're living your dream, but your dream didn't happen out of happenstance. You made it happen. And I want to go back. So born and raised in England, you got a computer science degree at Leeds University.
Yes.
Started a computer software business. Where is that transition to starting a database for movies, which was totally a passion project, and then eventually acquired by Amazon in 1998.
Yeah. Oh, what I could speak for hours on this. So I'm going to give you quite a focused version. So I'm very passionate about film. All of life's riddles are answered in the movies. And everything in my life is about film. And I was born at a very lucky time, very fortunate time, in that I became a teenager at the time when the home video was launching in the UK. My family got a VCR in 1981, which was relatively early in UK kind of time. And then at the same time, I had this interest in technology, and similar to you, actually, my interest in technology was through the movies. So I had seen all of these science fiction films where showing you the possibilities of technology that you maybe wouldn't have been able to fathom back in those late 70s, early 80s days. And so I became fascinated in technology through the movies. Then I ended up with my own home computer, and I had this interesting problem, which is I was seeing so many movies on VHS, I could no longer remember which ones I'd seen and which ones I hadn't seen. So I did the classic film geek thing, which is get a paper diary and I would write down what I saw on what day. But I'm interested in who wrote it, who shot it, who directed it, who produced it, who was in it. And you can't do that in a little tiny paper diary. So I went to my little home computer, created a database of the movies that I'd seen. And I used to rewind the VHS tapes, ridiculously geeky, okay? And I would type in the end credits of the movies into my database. So I was doing that on my home computer. Now, at the same time, this whole world of early computer games was getting started. So I was a bit of a gamer. I don't know. I'll confess this. I have never spoken about this before, really. But I'll confess this to you. You're such a trustworthy guy. By the late 80s, I'd become slightly addicted to computer games, and do you remember the game Tetris? Where in fact there was a movie about it last year.
Yes.
And so the blocks would fall and you would tilt and you'd make a line and away it would go, kind of thing. I got to the point where I no longer needed a computer to play Tetris. I was just seeing the blocks falling down in front of me. And yes, I got home.
And full Matrix.
Yeah, full Matrix. I got home from work one day and so we were married by 1989. And I said to my wife, I said, I'm addicted to Tetris. I'm done with computer games. So I haven't played a computer game since 1989. But I began in computer games. So on the same computer I had my digital film diary, I started to write and design computer games, and I would advertise them in the computer magazines that were available back at the time, and people would send a check through the mail, and I'd post them a little cassette with the game on back to them. And so that was my entrepreneurial journey. There was, as a 14-year-old, I was running a software business. My mother was the kind of person who banked the checks. She did all the post office work, kind of thing, and you know, she got a percentage of the revenue, kind of thing.
So you did well.
Yeah, well, it was successful. There was this brief window where there were enough people using the particular computer that I had that there was enough to it paid for all my driving lessons, it paid for all my VHS tapes, pay for all my rentals, pay for all my clothes, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So not the kind of thing where you could go, oh, I'm going to form my own business that would last years. It was definitely right place, right time, computer games for this brand of computer. I think I'm a better person for that. Because I realized I needed to focus on my studies, I need to go get my college degree, and go that route. But it did give me that kind of sprinkle of entrepreneurial seeds in my life. So there I am, 1981, type in film credits into my computer. Now, important lesson comes from this, by the way. Again, summer of 81. I'm at home. It's the vacation from school holidays. I'm rewinding tapes. I'm typing credits in. I'm watching movies. And my mother, the same mother, bursts into my bedroom one day. And she's like, why don't you go outside and play? And I'm saying, I'm just adding another report to the database. I'm just adding another column. I'm just doing that. And she rolled her eyes and left the room in disgust. But the important lesson, I think, here, and I tell this to people quite often, and I like to think that my wife and I modeled this with our own kids, is never crush a child's dreams, no matter what their interest is. You don't know how that interest and that passion in life may translate into something that has an impact in the world, or even just has an impact in their own life. You know, gives them a sense of purpose, gives them a sense of direction. Those kind of things. So although my mother was kind of slightly disappointed that I was in my bedroom spending a lot of time on my computer, I like to think that, that something good came of that. So be supportive.
That's very interesting. I never thought about it that way. I think a lot of parents have a negative connotation towards video games, and I think myself included. But I guess it's almost like the Socratic method of pushing your children. If they have a passion that you may not necessarily, and this is a generational view too.
Yes.
Is you can help them learn from that experience and segue either into pursuing that or helping them with the lessons they learned from whatever their passion was into other things. That's.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't have to translate into a career. It can translate into important life lessons that shape you as a person and make you a better person. I love the story when Leonardo DiCaprio won his Oscar for The Revenant, and he thanked, he did the classic thing, which many people do. He thanked his mother. But then he went on to tell the story of how she would drive him for 2 hours for acting lessons. And if she hadn't, I don't know if she knew back then that he would be one day where he is. I'm sure there were plenty of mothers that did those kind of driving backwards and forwards. And it didn't necessarily translate into the career that Leonardo DiCaprio has had. But maybe it translated into something that gave that person confidence. In their own ability, their confidence to pursue an entirely different career than acting. So, great believer in storytelling and great believer in letting young people go forwards and do what they want to do.
I wonder if Leo's mom also taught him to never date women over the age of 24. I'm kidding. Different subject. So this was very much a passion project for you, your love of movies. At what point did it start to change? And from my understanding is you started to bring in other people with passion for movies to help build out the database, correct? So you sort of made a public effort.
Yeah. Yeah, so that early 80s database, I'm using the word met in an interesting form. I on digitally online in a movie discussion group, I started to chat to other people who were also as interested in film credits as I was. One thing led to another, and on the 17th of October 1990. We published the very first version of the IMDb software. So I wrote that software. We took data that a number of us had been collecting together and we'd been working with people in the discussion group to kind of send information in to us. We launched with cast and director. So the very first early version of IMDb. No World Wide Web. You would have to download it to your own computer and you would be able to search who directed and who was in a small number of movies. But within a couple of weeks of launching, someone mailed me and said, "Hey, love the database, but I'm a big fan of writers. Have you thought of adding writers?" And so I gave them all the writers from my film diary database, some software that enabled them to manage contributions coming in, software that would enable them to publish it out, and I modified the database software so you could search for writers. A few weeks later, same thing with composers. A few weeks later, same thing with cinematographers. A few weeks later, same thing with producers. And so we built this entire thing with volunteers, never met each other, no concept of a live video call over the internet. International phone calls were too expensive. So all we did, everything was coordinated via email. Now, all of this is going on. We get to 1993, and I get an email from a guy called Rob Hartill, a guy in Cardiff in Wales. So just 40 miles away from where I was based, and I'm still based. And Rob's email goes something like this. I love these classic emails. "Hi, Col. Just installed the movie database software. Think it's great. But have you heard of this World Wide Web thing? Because I think it might be quite big and would love to write a wrapper around the software to make it a website. Okay. Now context is everything here. There's barely any actual websites out there.
Yes.
We were somewhere in the 100-ish first websites to launch. And the reason I know this is there used to be a website called What's New on the Web. And what they would do is every day they would list the newest 3 or 4 sites that went live yesterday. And you could basically work your way back in time until you got to the birth of the web. So we're super early, and it has been an advantage. Sometimes when people ask me for business advice, I always like to use movie references when I give advice, and I end up telling people, well, what you really need is a time traveling DeLorean. And you need to go back to 1993 and be one of those early websites. Now, obviously, that's not really practical advice, but you do have to think this through. So super early out of the gate. We're all volunteers. There's no commercial use of the internet. It's on a college web server. Not many people are using the college web server because not many people are using the web. So we soon filled up all of the capacity at Cardiff University's web server, and we ended up with copies of IMDb spread throughout the world on different college servers. Then 1995 arrives. And the web really starts to take off. And given this is a US podcast, some listeners may remember AOL discs, America Online. Everywhere you went, they would hand you a disc to get online. You couldn't buy any gas without getting an AOL disc. You couldn't go to the convenience store without getting an AOL disc. And so all of a sudden, we found ourselves in this world where the amount of traffic we were getting was doubling every 2 weeks. And if the amount of traffic doubles every 2 weeks and you rely on people using your service to send information in, the amount of information coming in doubles every 2 weeks. And your little hobby that you used to do on a Saturday morning before you took your kids to the park, which was, my thing, suddenly takes on a little bit more of a life of its own. And so we were faced with this really difficult decision. Did we say that was a fun 5 years, but we just can't keep up? And many services early in the internet, 95, took that option. They were just, we can't do this anymore. We took the other route. We decided we'd see if we could incorporate. We would see if we could sell some advertising with the aim that one or two of us could work maybe part-time to keep this going. And again, context is everything. You might be thinking, really? Like this guy's on the podcast. He's supposed to be a business entrepreneur, and he's been online for 5 years and didn't see the opportunity. But in 1995, you could count the number of websites that were ad-supported on two hands. Nobody knew if they were profitable, if they were going to be around, if there was any future for this. So we took the plunge. We divided the shares of the company up amongst our volunteer data managers and some of the additional software writers that had come aboard. We figured out a way that depending on how long you'd been involved and how much work you were doing, you would get a certain allocation of the shares in the company when we incorporated. We launched imdb.com in time for the Oscars in 1996. We bought our first web server on a credit card. So we took no venture capital money at all. It was just a credit card. One of our team in Wisconsin went to his local computer store with one of our credit cards from the UK and bought a web server. He drove it to his internet service provider, and we'd done a deal with them where we would promote them on our homepage and they would give us the bandwidth in exchange. And IMDb.com launched in time for the Oscars, as I say. 2 weeks later, I'm on the phone to our first potential advertiser. They've never bought any advertising before. I've never sold any advertising before. And so they say, so how much is it for a month? And I'm thinking, a month? I don't know. And so I name a number. I'm not going to tell you what the number is. But we owed, on the credit card, we owed X dollars. And so I named 3X dollars. They went, sure, we can do that. So close the deal. It's only 2 weeks in. So we were able to pay off the credit card before it became the bill was due, and thus became the world's first profitable internet company. Okay.
Now
there probably were some other profitable internet companies, but we'd never heard of any of them. So kind of that was early-ish in 1996. By the summer of 96, we sold our first piece of advertising to an actual movie studio. So that was my cue to give up my day job. So I gave up my day job, became our sole employee. And from that point onwards, I was running yet another list, a list of our volunteer shareholders who were brave enough to quit their job and join the team, not knowing whether there was any future in it. And as soon as the revenue run rate would afford another salary, I would phone up the person who was on the team that was next and say, hey, quit your day job, join the team. Now, I figured that I should at least speak to them once by phone before they quit their before they quit their day job. But we could have done it by email, but did it by phone when you were getting hired. And so that was all going really, really well across the rest of 96, across 97. And then in December 97, I got an email from a guy called Alan Kaplan. Alan was at the time general counsel, Amazon.com. And Alan sent me an email, and it's goes exactly like this, because I've still got a copy. Most important email I've ever received in my life. Hi, Cole. Jeff Bezos and I were discussing movie websites, and naturally, IMDb came up in the conversation. We're going to be in the UK in January 98, and would love to meet to discuss some business ideas. Are you available? Now, the funny thing, after Alan's email where he introduces Jeff, he put in parentheses, he said, Amazon.com's founder and CEO. So we're in a situation where you would have to introduce who Jeff Bezos was in an email conversation. So had heard of Amazon because they were advertising with IMDb, mailed back and said yes. But you have to kind of put this in context again. If today I was running a small startup company and I got that email, before I'd even replied, I would be breaking out the exit champagne. I'd be thinking about what dream I may have that I could now solve through financial resources and whatever. But at the time, Amazon.com had only been a publicly traded company for 7 months. They only sold books, and they had never acquired another company before. So we thought we were going along to discuss an ad deal. Went along, met with Jeff. Jeff and I got on really, really well. Amazon and IMDb had a similar philosophy about customers. by the end of that day, we found ourselves agreeing in principle that it would be a great idea if IMDb was acquired by Amazon. I had to go back, the meeting took place in London. I had to go back to Bristol, mail the team and say, hey, I just had the most amazing meeting with Jeff Bezos. And they thought, and some replied with, wow, this sounds great. Others replied with, oh, I don't know. I don't know where Amazon is going. Anything could happen. Over the course of a trip to Seattle for me, some negotiation, on the 24th of April 1998, IMDb became a wholly owned subsidiary of Amazon.com. They kept me on to run it, so I'm founder and CEO, and here I am coming up to 26 years at Amazon. They hired everybody else, the people who already work for IMDb directly, the remaining volunteers who wanted to come aboard, all hired. And there we were, Amazon's. Now, I say first ever acquisition. Amazon acquired three companies on the same day. They acquired a UK bookseller, which went on to become Amazon.co.uk. A German bookseller, which went on to become Amazon.de, and IMDb, which remains IMDb. And at the time, the media coverage was something along these lines. Amazon.com buys UK bookseller, check. Amazon.com buys German bookseller, check. Amazon.com buys film and television entertainment website, IMDb. What? What? You know, like how could, you know, what was going on here? So then a few months later, Amazon's video store opened, powered by IMDb, and it then is a case of, oh, now we see. Then the UK video store opened. Oh, now we see. A few years later, Amazon began to sell movies that you could download because the internet wasn't fast enough to stream them live. You could buy an episode of Friends and it would take like 4 hours to download and then you could watch it on your laptop, but powered by IMDb. Then Amazon Instant Video launched with powered by IMDb. And it's, oh, now we see. Then Amazon Studios launched. Oh, now we see. Then the Kindle Fire tablet launched with a feature called X-Ray. I don't know if you're familiar with this feature. If you have a Fire TV stick, you're watching a movie, press pause, the headshots of everyone in the current scene pops up. You can see what trivia is available. You see the soundtrack. All of that powered by IMDb. Oh, now we see. Then the Alexa voice devices, well, the Alexa voice devices that used to be this big and now they're this big, launched. And the chances are, if you ask Alexa an entertainment-related question, Alexa will answer using information from IMDb. And I use this illustration often, but I think it does resonate quite well. In 1990, if you had said to me, Carl, one day, customers will interact with IMDb by voice to a device this small, and the device will answer by voice, I would say, oh, really, seriously, that's something from a science fiction film. To quote the Terminator, they can't make things like that. And yet here we are in this world. And so it's been 26 years of this, and we IMDb does things on our own, and we do things in partnership with Amazon. But the important thing is to share that passion that we have for movies, for TV shows, with our audience. But more recently, that the whole of the entertainment space is changing, thanks to digital technology. People now as well as appearing on movies and shows, they go on web series. They go on movies and shows that are made for streaming. They appear in video games. They appear in music videos. They appear on podcasts. And so that whole world is now interconnected. If you're a fan of somebody, you want to know when they're on a podcast. You want to know that they're in a new video game, they're on a new web series, they're in a new movie. And so IMDb's expanded to cover all of those content types. We will continue to grow as that entertainment kind of world expands to things that you and I can't even think of today. Will be covered on IMDb at some point in the future when it's relevant for our audience. So it's been an exciting time of certainly pinching myself every day. am I really here? And along the way, Amazon has grown in itself and is so much bigger than the book retailer that we met with in January of 1998.
Most powerful company. Honor, if you ask me.
One of the interesting things about the way Amazon operates is that there's a little secret internal tool. It's kind of like the digital phone book for the company, and we're into measuring everything. Okay, that's one of the secret sources. Measuring everything. And so you can actually find out, as an Amazon employee, you can find out how many people have been at Amazon longer than you have. Okay, so how many people have joined after you and how many people have joined before you who are still there? And I'm now at number 22. So there are only 22 people at Amazon that have been at Amazon for longer than 20 coming up to 26 years. One, of course, is Jeff Bezos. One is Andy Jassy, who's the CEO now. Yes. It's a very strange world in which I live.
I've got so many questions. I'm going to back up. So
yeah, sure.
When you decided to make it your day job,
yeah.
What was the family's reaction? And we all know wife has the biggest say. Were they supportive or were they hesitant in certain
ways? I owe Tom Cruise a debt of thanks here. Okay. So here you go. And I barely ever get to tell this story as well. So there we were. It's the summer of 96. We've sold some advertising to a movie studio. And do we take the next step and do I quit my day job and make IMDb my day job? Okay, so this is the dilemma that my wife and I are in. We have, at this point, we have twin daughters. They're about to be 31. But back in the summer of 96, they were 3 years old. So we had two kids under four. My wife at the time, well, she's still my wife. my wife was full time with the kids at home. So we were on a single wage. And do I quit the day job for this adventure? And so I'm sure you know what this is like. Trying to make a decision like that with two kids under four running around you, it's not the kind of thing that you can easily do at home. So we're regular moviegoers. We have a regular babysitter. And so we organize with our babysitter to stay. We're going to be a little longer this time because we're going to go out and we are going out to see Mission Impossible. Okay. Now, unbeknownst to our babysitter, we're going to go for a pizza after Mission Impossible, come out of the movie theatre, go to the pizza place, another advantage of going to the movies. And we're going to talk through everything about quitting the day job and what the risks are and everything like that. And so we go see Mission Impossible. And I don't know how well you remember the original movie, but Tom Cruise's character, Ethan Hunt, he has a web browser. He's doing live video. The whole movie is centered around this world of technology, the web. and so we end up in the pizza place, and I turn to Karen and I say, well, if it's in a Tom Cruise movie, this is definitely going somewhere. So Tom Cruise may have recruited many people into the military via Top Gun, but he also recruited at least one person into the tech industry via Mission Impossible. And it was such a, we barely even needed to eat the pizza. It was such an obvious thing that we should do. But had we chosen a different movie, I don't know how things might have turned out.
Well, thank God to Tom Cruise and thank God to the universe just aligning those movies. In retrospect, when Jeff approached you, did you think it was too premature, or do you think the timing was right, or do you wish you had held on a little longer?
Oh, no, the timing was exactly right. Okay, this is again something that not everybody is fortunate to be in this position, but the best time to sell your company is when you don't need to sell your company. So we were not looking to be acquired. We were, in fact, here's a fun little secret. We were profitable. And at the time, Amazon was famously unprofitable.
Yes.
So we were the business that was making a profit, and Jeff was having a meeting with us, making a loss. So which made for an interesting dynamic. But obviously that was part of the plan, and to reach the kind of scale that Amazon's been able to reach, it worked out. But back in those days, because we didn't need to sell, we knew that at any point in the negotiation we could walk away and we'd be carrying on running a profitable business. But it was just so well timed. So if I had that DeLorean to travel back in time, I would say to myself, yep, go ahead, make sure you do this deal. So I would not change a thing about that in terms of timing or the structure or anything. It's genuinely been a delight. And the funny thing is, so sometimes people say, well, So you were running a software business when you were 14. You were there. You were running IMDb since you were 23 as a volunteer operation, and running IMDb as a commercial operation since you were 29. Like, why are you still at Amazon 26 years later?
You love it.
But I love what we do. I love what we do for our customers. I love our ability to connect our audience with great shows, great movies, great podcasts, great video games that they might otherwise miss. Because we're all the world we live in today, we're overwhelmed with choice amongst all of the entertainment that we have available. IMDb now lists more than 17 million titles, and we added 4.5 million of those last year. Last year alone. So the space that we're in is expanding, and for me, the reward of helping customers with that discovery, helping people answer that question that enables them to sleep at night, who was that person in that film, helping them find the next story that may change their life, I imagine if we could watch this, where we're in a world where it's young Mike today and IMDb connect you with the story, the film that makes you choose the career that you chose. And we never know that. But we know it happens. We know it happens, but we don't know the individual instances. Apart from, obviously, every now and again, people come up to me and they go, oh my goodness, I was on IMDb, I found this movie, I saw it, it changed my life. It made me do this instead of that. It made me see what a possibility for this is. And that's the beauty, because at the end of the day, all of life's riddles are answered in the movie. So I would absolutely do everything the same. Because I'd be worried a little bit. Back to the Future Part Two. You never know if you change anything. What other thing will?
Yeah.
It could be terrible. But the fun is, about every 18 months, around about 50% of what I do compared to 18 months ago, I no longer do. And I'm doing a different 50%, but it's always a different portion of it. So there are some things that I've done the same for all the way through since 1990, through 1981. But there are other things that I'm doing now that I know in a couple of years there'll be a team that does this, or the technology will have changed so that we don't need to do this ourselves anymore. And that's what makes it fun, and that's what makes it like. So I feel like my job has evolved so much over the past 26 years, over the past 34 years, and that's why I'm still inspired. And I genuinely get up every morning excited about what the challenges for the day might be, but also what the fun for the day might be. I'm off to Sundance later this week. I'm going to see some amazing movies. I may get to meet some amazing people who made those movies. And some of them may tell me that they themselves became filmmakers because of a passion that IMDb ignited in them. And I've had that happen to me with several people within the industry. So it's quite an honor to do this.
You know, the thing you said about twin daughters of three and wrestling with that decision, I think there's so many human beings who are in a job but want to pursue a different passion. And that is one of the most difficult decisions to make. I would say to pass on a secure paycheck.
Yeah.
But, you know, being an entrepreneur, and I'm still in my infancy, I'm only 5 years retired, and it is still a slugfest every
day. I mean, don't assume that anything that I've said is, you know, success is not guaranteed. You're going to get, and certainly we did, get so many things wrong along the way. But the important thing is how you deal with when things go wrong. Can you get up, dust yourself off? And these are all that, like you've literally had a career where you physically got up and dusted yourself off. These are all kind of like mental decisions that you make to dust yourself off and go, well, you know, I learned how not to do that. everything is a learning, and I'm always wary of things going too successfully, because I'm the kind of person that then goes,
oh no,
wait a minute. Yeah, if this has gone so well, did we maybe not pushed ourselves enough? We maybe didn't stretch ourselves here. Let's think about how we can double down on the success. But certainly, success is learning from your failures is definitely more vital than celebrating the successes. It's fun to celebrate the successes, but you don't learn anything that can get you ready for the next level.
And failure is life's greatest mentor.
Yes.
And failure is not an indictment on your character. It's just you're human. Everything has to do with what you do next. But the point where I was going with that is, you know, I know the two three-year-old little girls were probably one of the biggest factors in your decision. When you think about it, had you chosen to stay with what was safe, all the lessons you would have failed to teach your daughters that they've watched you go through. And I'm sure they have immense, one, love and appreciation and respect for what you've done for their lives. But for everyone listening, give it a shot. What's the worst that can happen? You fail. You know, people fear failure because they you know, they're always concerned of what will people think. People have their problems. They're not concerned about your failures. They're concerned about yours. But
Do you know the story that Jeff Bezos tells about the founding of Amazon, where he was in a similar, very, very, very secure job on Wall Street in New York, and he has the opportunity to maybe start an internet business. And the kind of framework that Jeff uses, and he teaches this in a lot of what he says, was he imagined himself as an 80-year-old, and he thought, would 80-year-old me look back and think, oh, I was right to stay in that safe job, or would 80-year-old me be more inspired by I went out there, I took a step out there, and whether it worked or not, in Jeff's case, clearly it worked, whether it worked or not. And he calls that the regret minimalization framework. So to think, well, what's the worst that can go wrong? You're going to learn a lot about how not to start a business, and you may be able to trade that into something that tells you how to start a business or how to do whatever. And not everything. This is general life advice. It doesn't only apply in business.
No, it doesn't. And I like that regret mitigation framework. That's I like the way he powers that. Cole, what is the staff of IMDb today?
Hey. Well, so the funny thing is we don't disclose staff numbers.
I can only imagine the amount of information that goes up. It's gotta be insane.
I am very proud of our team, which operates across multiple countries. We have it's so interesting where we're based around the world. We have 23 and a half hours out of 24 coverage. So there's somebody in an IMDb office and working on IMDb for 23 and a half hours of every 24 hours because of the nature of time zones and where we're based. But the thing that still inspires me is you might think that things would be slowing down and that we must have every piece of information. But given the production of all of the title types that we cover, I'm not even sure whether 4.5 million a year titles, 4.5 million new titles in a year, covers everything that was produced in that year. When you think our mission is to cover every type of entertainment, every country, every language, every time period, all of the different media that I've talked about. So we usually process somewhere between 1 million and 2 million updates per week. So when you land on an IMDb page that has like cast and crew and soundtracks and plot keywords, and trivia and trailers and all of the things. You land on a name page, it's got a biography, it's got family members, it's got quotes, it's got trivia, it's got pictures, all of those things. There are between 1 and 2 million updates across the whole catalogue that land you on the version of the page that you look at. And the chances are, If you reload a popular page 10 minutes later, there's something on there that wasn't there 10 minutes ago.
I'm a small business owner, and I could not imagine running such an innovative, rapid growth company like you do. I have a lot of respect for passionate business leaders, and I hope to be able to be in your seat one day and say, yeah, I grew this to X number.
But the trick is never to get complacent about this. And we're all a couple of bad decisions away from possibly losing customer trust and that kind of possibility. But the thing with the scale is it does present challenges. And the other thing that's going on is that customer expectations are always rising. So way back in 1990, the fact that you could get the director and four cast members of a film on a little a little computer display was people saw that and they would think, my goodness, that is remarkable that you can do that. Now people take that for granted. People take for granted that you can interact with IMDb by voice. They take for granted that we have all the information on all of the new shows. And so their customer expectations are always rising. And you have this dual responsibility in terms of managing customer expectations because first of all, you absolutely have to listen to your customers. You have to listen to where they're going, what their needs are. That's the easier bit because the beauty of the internet is they're very customers are great at telling you what they think and what they want and what you can do better. They're great at that.
Yeah,
it's one of the wonders of the internet in an interesting sort of way. But equally, you have to invent on behalf of customers. You have to be thinking, what do they? Where is this going? What might they want in 1 year? What might they want in 2 years? And what can you do, or what can we do at IMDb today that moves us towards? So it's kind of, you know, it's a sporting analogy. Is you play to where the ball will be, not where it is now.
I've heard so many business leaders say, if we could just get to this dollar amount in EBITDA, we can coast. And I always sort of tilt my head. I'm like, I don't think that's how that works. I think actually, you're busier. You're improving your product. You're improving your service. You've got more people, which people are your greatest asset. They're also your greatest liability.
And that
comes with growth, comes with challenges. Cole, you know, clearly, one, I'm glad, and I know we were supposed to have you on in July, schedules conflicted. I'm really glad that you came on because, one, I can tell your optimism is through the charts. You're passionate. You're logical. I have a feeling that when you face adversity, you smile and maybe console other people. Hey, this too shall pass. But as an innovative leader of one of the just greatest stories of the modern era, what is your number one leadership tip, whether it's business, life, the thing that has like been your guiding principle for all of us who are listening, mainly me?
here you go. All right. So it starts with customer obsession, but let's take that as a given. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's take that as a given. The one of the biggest problems that companies face as they expand is losing contact with the customer front line. Okay. When it's me and a group of volunteers who are waiting to be hired, when it's that small team within Amazon, we're all using the product every day. Mm-hmm. Everybody who's involved, everybody is involved, is they're in it because they joined the mission. They joined the mission. They're true believers in what we're trying to do for customers. But as a business grows, you need to bring in people from the outside, and that this is a good thing.
Yes,
this is a good thing. And like, may we all start businesses where we grow to the point where we do need to bring people in from the outside. It's a privilege to be running something where you need to. But those people didn't go through that same startup journey that you did. And after a while, those people are hiring people that in turn don't even have their knowledge and their experience of where the company is going, what the company is about. And many businesses fail when they lose contact with the customer frontline. So you need to understand your customers. You cannot hire, like we cannot hire people at IMDb who only ever are like as big a movie fan as me. It's great when we hire people who are as big a movie fan as me. That is always great. That's always a bonus. But if someone is the best data engineering person, they're the best data engineering person. You want to hire them whether they love movies or not. I would hire people, and what we do things that inspire people to like movies and shows. I'm taking my team out to see my Seattle team, which is where I am today. I'm taking my Seattle team out to see a movie tonight. And so even if they're like, well, I'm just in data analytics, I don't really go to movie theaters. It's kind of like, hey, the CEO is paying. It's a personal thing. We'll have some fun. We're going to talk about the movie afterwards. We're going to have a great time. And maybe I can inspire a spark of interest in film as a result of that. Well, that person will still be a great data engineer, yes. great analyst. But when companies don't have that connection to their customers, and you can do that in various ways. You can do the thing where you encourage your team to be the missionaries that you started out as, but you can also create mechanisms that make sure they stay in contact with customers. Yeah. Make sure that they know how people are using what you're building. So we do things like we do have a customer service team that work at IMDb, but we also do customer service on a kind of open customer service forum where customers can come and they can complain and raise their grievances, and then we take turns in handling that. Like I make a point of every single day going onto our customer support forums, public facing, and sometimes I answer, or sometimes I just point somebody in the direction of something that needs an answer. And sometimes the team are handling everything perfectly. But it makes a difference when the person who wrote the team developing the iPhone app for IMDb, they can see, we got that wrong. We didn't think of the use case of the show times in this location and whatever. And they see that feedback. And not only do they see that feedback, but they also get that little feeling of satisfaction when they go, hey, we're going to fix that today. We're going to fix that today. And I don't know, like sometimes I interact as a person in the real world. I interact with businesses where you get the feeling that the person on the phone has got no idea what the experience is. You're sitting in front of something that doesn't work, and they've never used the things that doesn't work. So how on earth are you gonna understand what my problem is? Understand how you could build something better for me? So my beyond always being customer obsessed is always stay in touch with the customer frontline. And I think Harvard Business School I've got some kind of free online training about customer frontline that discusses these kind of issues, because it's It is super important, and it makes a difference at the end of the day.
And it's about relationships with the customer.
Yep.
You can't have personal relationships with each customer, but IMDb can definitely stay in touch and answer their needs. Well, Cole, I can't thank you enough. One, you are a warrior, a leader that I would definitely work for any day of the week, just from the passion alone.
Thank you for
somebody who has gone to the website or the app multiple times sitting in the theater, it's sort of surreal to be sitting here with the man who created it all. So have fun at the Sundance. I cannot wait to write this article on this podcast. I've got about 2 pages worth of notes that I'm ready to blast off, because there's something that we can all learn.
Now one thing, I did do a little bit of prep for this. I love talking about IMDb, and I believe you were going to ask me for some recommendations of movies to see. Do you want to do that?
Let's have it. You know it, with 15,300 unique films under your belt, send it. We're all yours.
All right. So do you want me to do these live now?
Yes, do these live now.
Yeah. Okay. Because I thought about this, and the challenge with this, of course, everybody is a product of all of the movies that they've seen already, and all of the movies that they haven't seen yet, kind of thing. So we're coming up with a short list. If aliens landed tomorrow and I needed to capture the essence of going to the movies, right now, today, these would be where I would start. So I recommend everybody start with a silent film. And this is a Buster Keaton movie called Steamboat Bill Jr. It's from 1928. And I've seen this film many times, but I had the pleasure of seeing it with 80 grade school kids about 5-6 years ago. And they laughed and they cheered and they whooped and they hollered. And if any movie today can have the same impact some 85 plus years later, then that would be a great thing. And it does. So Steamboat Bill Jr. Okay. You need then, I think, a classic movie. So I just love Casablanca. Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, love, choices, all of the things that come to the surface in that movie. So well written, so well acted, so well told, and absolutely timeless. So Casablanca. We need to get people into the world of color. So for color, I have Vertigo, which is my all-time favorite film. 1958, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. This is the film that changed my view on cinema. I saw it for the very first time in November 1989, and it instantly became my all-time favorite film, and it's been my all-time favorite film for 35 years. I don't want to, for anyone who's not seen it, I don't want to reveal any twists or anything like that, but it holds up remarkably, and is a model for how you can make a film with the combination of script, of plot, of cinematography, of music, of production design, of direction, of editing. It's such a film. Now, not all movies are in English. We need to be brave, people.
Foreign.
So there are movies from pretty much every culture in the world. The technology exists for people to tell their stories. So I'm going to pick a film from 5 years ago, from 2019, which is Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is a French movie. I saw it at the Cannes Film Festival. Really makes you think about relationships and about film as well, of course. recent movie. So we all need to have like a recent thing that we can catch and say, hey, we saw this. So last year at Sundance, I saw a brilliant British film. It's in my very top 10 list of 2023, a movie called Rye Lane, R-Y-E, Rye Lane. It's from 2023. I think in the US, it's now available on Hulu, if I'm allowed to say that. And it's just a brilliantly simple love story about two people who meet on one day and all of the things that can go right with that and all of the things that can go wrong with that. So I knew when I saw it at Sundance last year, it was going to be in my favorite films of the year. And then we should always have a film that is to come. So right now, I am recommending to people a movie I saw in Toronto called Hitman. It's going to be coming to Netflix later in 2024. And it's film directed by Richard Linklater. And it stars Glenn Powell.
Yes. Yeah.
Past guest.
Yes.
Of the podcast. I've met Glenn a couple of times, and I loved it when he came on the podcast. So,
and he's an Austin native. So yeah, we're very proud of Glenn.
Yeah. So those are my six movies that you should go see.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to ask two additional questions to that. Comedy. What's your favorite comedy?
Oh, my all-time favorite comedy is Bringing Up Baby from 1938. It's the Howard Hawks film with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. My favorite actor and my favorite actress. Funniest movie ever made.
And then, very selfishly, military genre.
Military genre. My favorite film is Zero Dark Thirty.
Interesting.
In that genre, Zero Dark Thirty.
Yes. Funny enough, when that came out, I was sitting in Afghanistan with a JSOC operator who had lived through that entire period and just listening to his comments about I was there. I remember when that happened. I was involved in that. It was I was glued to him more than I was glued to the movie. It was a good movie. Great movie.
Yeah.
Well, Cole, that's good. That's going to be a separate segment. Love films. With Cole Needham. I can't thank you enough.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.